This is The Unseen, and I'm your host, Mike Cleland. On this week's show, I am happy to have as my guest, my friend, William J. Konkoleski, and for this show, I will be calling him Bill. He wrote a book in 2009 titled Experiencer, and the subtitle is Raised in Two Worlds. This is a short, tidy, well-written book, and it talks about his experiences as a boy, coming to terms with his direct contact experiences. For this conversation, we will talk about a lot more than just the content of that book. We'll talk about things that take us right up into the present day within his life. I don't want to waste too much time here at the beginning with this intro, so I want to jump right into the interview. This audio conversation was recorded Thursday, October 10th, 2019. Please enjoy. Bill, I want to thank you so much for saying yes to this interview. It means a lot to me.
Thanks for having me on, Mike. It's good to reconnect.
Yeah, we met a few years ago at a conference, and we've also over the years had a handful of phone conversations, which I've always enjoyed. I can relate to your story partially because of the Michigan thing. When I read your book, there's so many references to towns and streets and the weather. It just felt like kind of a funny sort of deja vu for me, even though I really didn't have any knowledge of any of this until I was in my late 20s. Like it hadn't surfaced for me really until I was probably 30, really. So I was completely in the dark. I had some stories to tell, but your story is told in a book called Experiencer, and the subtitle is Raised in Two Worlds, and that came out in 2009. The question I want to ask is, how old were you when that book came out?
Let's see, that could be easy math. That was 10 years ago. I'm 48, so I was 38 when that came out.
The reason I'm asking this is because that seems young to do a book like that. It seems like most folks get into their 50s or so before they really write that book. What was your motivation for writing that book? It's a short little book. It's a great little read. It's a very simple book, and it's not intimidating at all. But what was your motivation to create this?
At the time, I didn't really have any connections in my life that would be problematic for me to put out the book. I was not a father yet, so I wasn't thinking, you know, is this appropriate to do with children? What I thought was that this was a good time to put it out, and when I did put it out. And also, when I put it out, I had reread some of the big UFO books about abduction that had sort of given me the courage to put mine out. And one of the things that I always sort of thought about many of these books is that they were excellent, but a lot of times there was what I would call maybe a little bit of filler in it. And so I wanted to put together a tight, lean book that just really focused on the experiences, which is what I think most people would get a book like that for. And it made it an easy, quick read. And also, I wanted to put together something that I already had written down in a journal for my own self. I wrote the book as much for me as for anybody else. I went through my experiences growing up. And one of the things that I thought was important about doing a book about experiences growing up is that there'd been some books that I'd seen out there. This is how children feel when they have abduction experiences. These books are looking at children objectively from a distance and speculating what it's like and making theories about what it's like to be a child who's an experiencer. Well, having grown up with my earliest experience at age 2, I thought, well, the most helpful thing that I can do to contribute to the dialogue is to write about what it's actually like growing up as an experiencer.
And so let's just start with that first experience, that experience when you were 2. Is this actually your first memory?
My very first memory in life. When I was 3 years old, I almost fell into Niagara Falls, and I have that memory quite clear too. But yeah, an even earlier memory was from age two. I was in my crib. It was at night. I was fully awake when a little gray being came into my room, stared down at me from over the edge of my crib, and was there for just a few moments as I screamed for my parents, who were in the next room, and they wouldn't come. My mom just said, "Go back to sleep, go back to sleep." And after a moment, the little being with its big black eyes just walked out of the room. I got the impression it was going to my brother's room. I have four older brothers, two of whom have a number of experiences, the other two, no experiences whatsoever, interestingly. But it wasn't a memory that came back to me years later, like, I think I remember this, you know, that kind of a thing. It happened to me and it burned in my memory and I never forgot it.
That is, to me, that very arresting. Just the thought of being so dismissed by your mother would be one thing. And then just, I mean, that's like a question a psychotherapist would ask. What is your very first memory? So at one point in the book, you talked about, like, how would you be in your life if you didn't have these experiences? Would you choose not to have these experiences? And I don't know if you remember the what you said in the book.
I do remember being asked by Sandy Nichols, a fellow experiencer, that I had the pleasure of, we were both on a 2002 Sci-Fi Channel TV show called The Abduction Diaries. And he asked me in a private phone conversation, you know, how would I feel if none of these experiences had ever happened to me? And I remember clearly saying back to him, I wouldn't recognize myself. I mean, I had an experience when I was 2, 4, 7, 9, 10, several times in my teens and 20s growing up. I just wouldn't, you know, I would have no idea what my life would have been like without these experiences. And that's, you know, hence my term Raised in Two Worlds for my book, which is I had a normal childhood. It was a fun childhood. I had a lot of friends, did a lot of cool things, absolutely normal. And then intermittently, I was being visited by little gray beings.
And I also say you're very, you certainly seem to be a very grounded, stable person, which is a relief given what these experiences, I've met some folks that these experiences have left them adrift and they are not grounded. So, and I also recognize, having grown up in Michigan, there is this sort of Michigan kind of politeness, let's say. And you just, I recognize that in you, that you're very aware of, I don't know, just like just getting along at a really high level, if that makes sense.
Thank you. Yeah, definitely take that as a compliment. And when one comes out with these experiences, you, of course, are very selective about who you share them with first. And my circle of people that I shared just kept growing and growing and growing. And I'm pretty much completely open about my experiences now. And I've described them to so many people so many times that it's really therapeutic to talk to people and share my experiences. There's, you know, I can't count, you know, on my hands and toes the number of people I can just pick up a phone at any time and have a in-depth discussion about the phenomena, either because they're dear friends or in many cases because they've had these types of experiences themselves. And, you know, my family, my friends, my work, all 110% supportive. I'm really blessed that way. And because that is the situation in my life, I feel sort of an obligation to be an ambassador, if you will, to the phenomena. It's not like I can speak on everyone's behalf. I can only speak about myself. But for me to be able to express what has happened to me personally, I think in my own imagination helps just a little bit when people wonder what kind of people are saying that they've been abducted. And I'll say, me? You want to hear about it? You got some time?
You told a funny story, like if someone meets you at a party and you're standing with your wife and says, "Oh, so what's going on in your life?" And I think she referred to it as the 6-hour story. Basically, you got 6 hours to hear the story.
Yes, that's exactly what she calls it. That's great that you remember that.
Well, that's the same thing with me too, because it's happened to me before, where you're like, just like, you can't sort of meet someone at a cocktail party and unload on them, because it, to tell the story correctly, is a serious investment in time and doing my own research, talking to people on the phones. And that's what you get. You have to listen for 6 hours before you really get a taste of what someone's been through.
I remember I was interviewed for a television program. I guess I don't want to get into the specifics. And they flew me out to Roswell from Michigan. They flew me out to Roswell, interviewed me in the Roswell Museum about my experiences for about 3 hours. And then when it was done, the director said, you know, that was really something. He said, I didn't expect you to be so detailed and credible and believable and, you know, likable, all these nice words, you know. And he goes, and because of that, he goes, I'm afraid we're not going to be able to use your footage. And I was kind of taken aback. And he said that they had actually brought me on as sort of a, you know, a wacky side of their UFO show. They expected me to say outrageous things, to be a bit silly, you know, at least be able to take a few quotes out of context and, you know, make light of the phenomena. But I let them down without knowing it. So, you know, self high five, I guess.
There's been a handful of quite good documentaries made in the last few years. And I just hope that trend continues, because the exploitative stuff, just, it's painful. It's damaging to me. I take it really personally.
Yeah, it's as if TV producers take the old adage, truth is stranger than fiction, which is really, you know, a great way to put the abduction phenomena. It's like they take that old adage, truth is stranger than fiction, and they take it as a dare. You know, they have this wonderful, bizarre array of stories that experiencers can share, and they just change them and mess them up and put words in the mouth of the experiencers and just edit it so badly and add the most bizarre special effects to it. And, you know, just on down the line, it's like, you know, if you just told the story straight and gave due credit to the person that is putting so much on the line, sharing their information publicly, you know, it would be so much better than what happens most of the time.
Oh, I just want to reach through my microphone and give you a big hug right now for saying that, because I feel the same thing with the stories themselves. And the problem is the stories are not simple, right? So television, I mean, I understand the limitations of trying to do a television show, and it's got to be dumbed down and simplified for the audience. And the stories are not simple. The stories require a lot of focus and a lot of patience. Hey, you, in your book, refer to something as your transformational event.
Mm-hmm.
What was that event?
Okay. and I will, forgive me, take the patience to do justice, I think, to the story. So I had picked up Whitley Strieber's Communion, and it terrified me. Actually, I remember I got it for my birthday. And
oh, here, quick, how old were you? You must have been quite young when that book came out.
I'm trying to think of which birthday it was.
That would have been 87 when that book came out.
Right. I got it for my birthday in 88, where I would have been 17, yeah.
Okay.
And the book was a two-edged sword for me. Because growing up and having a lot of weird experiences, I didn't really have a context to put it into. I didn't have somebody else's experiences to compare it to. I just had, you know, a lot of really weird things happen to me. And then as I would read his book, you know, these bombshells were dropping. I'm like, oh my gosh, it happened to me too. Oh my gosh, it happened to me too. And when he got to the part describing mantis beings, I'm like, not only have I seen mantis beings, but that's what I also call them. Oh, my gosh, the shivers I got from that. So it was a record for me finishing the book. I finished it in one weekend. I just did nothing but read this book. I could not put it down. At one point, I accidentally kicked a blanket off the bed when I was reading it in bed, and it startled me, and I jumped up and I screamed, and my parents came running in, and I had to explain to them, like, it's a really scary book, and the looks I got. So Transformation, if my timeline is correct, yeah, it came out in the, at least for me to ask for it for Christmas in that same year. And so in 88, I got it for Christmas. And unlike Communion, where I sped through it, I found myself dreading reading Transformation. I dreaded hearing all the things that might have also been true in my life. And I got to a point in the book where Whitley was talking about beings that called him telepathically out to a park, sort of put Lodge's telepathic messaging in his head to come out to the park, which he did. And I put the book down at that point. I'm like, wow, you know, there's something in the column that I can put that has never happened to me. I've never had some telepathic message just stuck in my head like that. And then right when I thought that, this message popped in my head. It felt like completely external, like somebody popping a cassette into my brain that said the message, finish the book and we will prove to you that we exist. And it was very clear and I couldn't make it go away. It occupied a spot in my thoughts, in my mind. It was just always there. It was some message I couldn't delete. It was just hanging there. And so then I started to read the book really, really slow. And I got to the point where I was up to the last chapter and I thought, well, I'm not going to read this because I just am not ready for whatever they're thinking they want to do to as their proof to me. So I put the book down and it was weeks, if I remember right, before I returned to it. And the reason I returned to it was I had a dream that I finished the book. One night I dreamt I finished the book. So I woke up. I'm like, well, I guess that's a sign. And I read the book first thing in the morning. And then the whole day I was terrified, just like, what's going to happen to me today? What is going to happen? Is it going to happen immediately? Is it going to happen soon? When's it going to happen?
Hey, I apologize. I'm going to have to interrupt and we are going to have to take our first break. For non-members, you are going to hear a few commercials. For paying members, we will be right back. We are back with William Konkoleski, and we are talking about his experiences and also his book, Experiencer, which is subtitled Raised in Two Worlds. Just before the break, I felt terrible, but I had to interrupt a very important story that he refers to as his transformation experience. You can pick up right where you left off.
Right. And to clarify that message, even though I was reading fairly clearly in, you know, Communion and also in Transformation, that there was now a very well-defined context for what was happening to me that I didn't have my whole life. You know, my family had a bunch of paranormal things going on to them above and beyond the abduction experiences that I was having. So I wasn't ready to just 100% say I'm being visited by ETs. It's a big jump, even if you're having those type of experiences. It's a big thing to admit to yourself that this is a reality and this is pretty much the form, the nature, of what is happening to you. And so hence, you know, finish the book and we'll prove to you that we exist. So I knew the proof was going to somehow be in the form of something that would define the nature of their reality, their existence. Were they extraterrestrial or something else? So that night, I was waiting all day. And that night, me and two friends were parked in a Chevette in front of another friend's house. It was 9 p.m. It was February of 89.
Oh, hold on. I got to interrupt. I drove a Chevette for a while.
So I blame you.
Okay. Go. Keep on telling.
They tracked UFOs. So we were parked in the Chevette. My two friends, Kyle and Don, were in the front and I was in the back seat. And we were waiting for another friend to get home from work. And it was about 9 p.m. Like I said, February, so it was dark. And we're just sitting there and this blue ball of light about the height of two telephone poles, slowly arced over the car. It was about the size of a car, kind of almost oval shape, and it appeared to be sort of spinning, tumbling like a football might, just slowly overhead. And we all three saw it and watched it till it disappeared, came in off the left of the vehicle, the driver's side, disappeared off the passenger side as it flew off into the distance. And then a white ball of light zigzagged all over the sky, ping pong, just single ball of light, just taking the entire expanse of the sky very quickly. And then that disappeared. And then a red light appeared in the center of the sky, grew, I would say, to about the size of the moon. Big, big. And then it shrank and disappeared. We all three saw it and agreed completely in what we had seen. And the next day, when I came into work, come to find out that our maintenance man at the job I was working had also seen a blue UFO the night before. So doubling down on the proof that, we will prove to you that we exist. And when I sat there, I'm like, well, these are UFOs. And that means UFOs means extraterrestrial, I guess. How much more do I know than that? I don't know. But so it was very clearly speaking to me that the experiences I was having was extraterrestrial in nature. And that was their proof. And even if I wanted to deny what I had seen and say, no, I'm must have just been seeing things. There are two other witnesses in that car that will never let me forget what the three of us had seen. And because I'm still close friends with these guys, and I lost touch with the maintenance guy at my job, but I mean, that was additional proof as well. So I'm like, wow, for me. And not only that, it really got me revved up to reach out to other people who'd had these types of experiences, to read just about anything I could on the phenomena, really face it head on. And I went from basically just being on defense every night, hoping something bad wasn't going to happen, to really getting motivated to participate in a community that was looking into this phenomena.
Now, in the book, there's a very odd thing where you talk about you had orange pop on the table.
Oh yeah, that same night. Yep.
And you had like a really negative, like a negative reaction just seeing orange pop after this event.
Yep. When the friend we were waiting for got home, she hopped in the car and we went over to her best friend's house. And so it was Orange Crush or maybe Faygo Orange, some kind of orange. I say Faygo. Hopefully many people know what I'm talking about.
I know what you're talking about. I'm from Michigan. Yeah. So many people won't know what pop is, but We're from Michigan. We both know what that means. But
so, orange pop right in front of me. And it just revulsed, I found it revolting, just repulsive. I just couldn't look at the color orange. The color blue of that UFO that I had seen was so captivating, so mesmerizing, so beautiful. So beautiful. It just the color just stunned me. It was just so wondrous. And anything that is on the opposite side of the color wheel from that blue, it just rubbed me the wrong way.
That is a remarkable little detail. That to me tells me something, I don't know how to even put it, something extremely powerful took place to have that curious reaction to the color orange. We haven't talked about this yet. You are the Michigan State Director for MUFON,
mm-hmm.
the Mutual UFO Network.
Yep.
And when did you become the State Director?
2004. So it's been 15 years, nearly 16 years now. I've been in the position of State Director for Michigan probably about three times as long as anybody else has done it.
And how old were you when you took on the post?
So doing the easy math again, that's 15 years. I would have been 33.
33. That is very young for a state director, isn't it?
It is. It's very young for a MUFON member. Period. God bless MUFON. I love MUFON. But
I'm getting darn near 60, and I go to these conferences, and I feel like I'm the youngest person in the room sometimes. So, mm-hmm. Yes, it's a lot of blue-haired people at these events. So
when the former state director was leaving his post because he was moving. He moved from Michigan to Arizona. One of the key things that why they tapped me is to help give MUFON a younger face. Here's somebody that was getting involved in the organization. So, you know, why not, you know, try to get MUFON into the 21st century with the younger generation type of a thing. And yeah, here I am still 15 years, 16 almost years later.
Now, I reached out to MUFON probably around 2009 and basically tried to get someone on the phone and say, I think I'm having these UFO contact experiences. What do I do? And there was nothing. There was just like, these people were like, I don't know. We don't know what you're supposed to do. And like, I was in Idaho and Wyoming. I was right on the border there. So I was calling both Idaho state director and Wyoming state director. One fellow did say, you know, who you should talk to? You should talk to Leo Sprinkle, which I did do. And that was wonderful. So that was the only advice I got. Leo Sprinkle lives in Laramie, Wyoming. Hmm. Now, in my senses, and I am not a member of MUFON, I'm seeing it from the outside, and that there's a tension, or maybe there was a tension within the membership, where they are sort of at a loss to how to deal with the contact experience, the abduction experience. And you are an experiencer, and you took on the role of state director. How did that all work out?
Well, when I to say how it happened in the first place, I first came to MUFON in 93. So I've been a member for 26 years now, and which is more than half of MUFON's 50 years now that it's been around. And I came to I told the state director at the time, Shirley Coyne, and her husband, George Coyne, about my experiences. They're both experiencers themselves. Shirley was a state licensed hypnotherapist, and so she was able to regress me. I was so blessed that she was able to regress me for free, knowing, you know, how much sometimes people get charged for a regression. But I just found it absolutely wonderful, and I knew at that point I just had to give back to MUFON. You know, I just, you know, I owed so much to MUFON for helping me through a very rough time in my life about my experiences. And so I, you know, I knew that I would devote my time, volunteer my efforts to help out. And because that, I just dove right in. It was my number one hobby, you know, MUFON. You know, I got moved up into the position that I was in 2004. And now I'm in a position where, as I think you were saying, that most of MUFON's focus is not on the abduction side of things. It's on the nuts and bolts, UFO sightings themselves. What color was the craft? At what altitude? How long did you see it? You know, et cetera, that sort of a thing. And we do our best to identify it, and we can, you know, at least 80% of the time identify what somebody's reporting to us. And therefore, we put it into the identified column and move on to the next sighting that we get. The whole chassis of MUFON was developed to investigate craft sightings, not entity sightings. And one of the things that when during the 80s and 90s, when they were really feeling the pressure, I think starting to feel the pressure about this aspect of the phenomena, they had already spent several decades as a UFO investigative outfit. And now they're getting these other types of stories, highly valuable witness accounts of very extraordinary, very important things. And one of the problems an organization like MUFON has with abduction events is, in a UFO report, it's a very quick sort of checkbox report form. And, you know, it followed up by, you know, maybe looking into the weather, some aircraft, flight patterns, things like that, and then you move on. But when somebody has this type of experience, when somebody has contact, very rarely do they have one contact. They're a good friend of mine, Jeff Westover, likes to use the term frequent flyer. It tickles me that, you know, a lot of these people who have abduction accounts or contact or, you know, whatever, they are things that have happened to them again and again and again. And every one of these experiences is a long, in-depth, very personal, detailed account. And when you take down a UFO report, it's lickety-split. There you go, got the details. But in these abduction events, these people who are experiencers, for every single experiencer making their report to MUFON, for MUFON to do these witnesses justice, they have to write a book, a whole darn book, to get the full story in from most of the people that are coming to MUFON and telling their accounts.
That's my sense too, and I've used the term, there's a novel that needs to be written about every person who's had these experiences.
Mm-hmm. And which is another thing that led me to write my own book, was I understood that nobody else would be able to write it or would have the time to write it. Sometimes witnesses will come to us and say, here's all my experiences. You know, are you going to put this into, you know, a big, long book-like narrative for me? And it's just so hard to many times keep up with these individuals. I tell you, most of the time when I'm on the phone with an experiencer, they will not catch a breath. They will just be so excited that somebody's going to listen to them, and they will talk for as long as you let them talk. And there is absolutely no way to keep up with them, to ask clarifying details. You know, it just is so much experience. And
it's the six-hour story.
Yeah. And it's a lot. And so when experiencer groups get together and are able to share their stories, that's probably the best thing, for an experiencer, is to talk to another experiencer. A lot of the people investigating these experiences, God bless them, haven't had their own experiences like this. And, it's sometimes difficult, I think, to really grok what is happening to some of these people without having had something happen to them themselves.
And this is, you and I are talking the same language here. Where I'm doing is very similar sort of, well, I'm focused completely on the contact experience in my research.
Yeah.
And I'm flooded. Like, I cannot keep up with my email inbox. I mean, there was a sort of a joke. There's a woman named Miriam Delicato. And I kind of asked her off the cuff. I said, hey, what's your proof that this stuff is real? And she looked at me. You want proof? Look at my email inbox. That's the proof.
Mm-hmm.
And I recognize that. This stuff is just flooding in. It's a avalanche, and it's hard to keep up with. It's impossible. I'll put it, it's impossible to keep up with it. And that's a shame. Because everyone needs to be heard, at least. And it's very difficult.
It's a funny irony, I think, too, that for those people far removed from UFO television shows, you know, people that just live their lives without putting a second thought to UFOs or contact or anything, many of them will walk around because I know people like this. So, it is true that they'll say, how come there's no proof? How come there's no evidence of this phenomena? And, you know, there isn't anything that could convince me. And then it's when you're embedded into the community, it's just like, you know, as you say, it's an avalanche. It is so much that you can't keep up with it all. And yet some people walk around this saying, you know, that it's not real, and there isn't any credibility to it. It's just such a strange dichotomy.
Agreed. Hey, we have reached the end of our half-hour mark. We're going to take our second and final break for free Dreamlanders. You will hear a few commercials. For paying members, we will be right back. We are back on The Unseen, and our guest this week is William Konkoleski. I'll be calling him Bill. And just before the break, we were talking about the difficulties of really allowing the people to tell their stories. And this is a nice format because I can allow people to tell their stories. And Bill, you told an amazing story, and you told it to me in person. I think this is going back 5 years ago now at that conference in Maine. And you actually talked about it from the stage there too. It's a story of a hypnosis event that took place, which I just found a remarkable story. If you could tell that, I would love to hear it.
Certainly. As I mentioned before, I had come to MUFON to to tell about my abduction experiences, and I was blessed to have Shirley Coyne, the then state director for Michigan. George Coyne was in many ways a co-director for Michigan, and they took me in, and she gave me several free hypnotic regression sessions. And I found them to be extremely helpful in unpacking what had happened to myself. And the one thing, though, is that with more knowledge of what was happening to me, I wasn't necessarily receiving more comfort. Knowledge was good. Knowledge helped me. But I was still nervous every night when I would go to bed. In my teen years, I had literally set up an obstacle course in my room of junk, and so that if anybody was coming in to take me, that they would have to contend with that, but didn't really work. They still came and they still took me.
And you had a fan, right? So you had a fan. So if they walked in front of the fan, you would actually sense that there was a break in the wind created by the fan.
Yep, and I made sure the window, the curtains were closed so that nobody could recon the room. I played drums in high school, and so I had a snare drum stick, an extra snare drum stick that I had sort of wedged between a dresser and a door so that you could only open the door so far, and then it would make a clunking sound. And I would have the lights on, and I would either be have the television or radio on, and... Yeah, it was. I did quite a lot in fear. It didn't work, but I continued to do it. And it was funny that even though my mom knew about my experiences and was supportive, it actually runs on my mom's side of the family. She even still wasn't a big fan of me having a messy room. She thought that was just an excuse for me, a teenager, to have a messy room. Oh, yeah, Ma, the aliens might come. I'm going to just do this. Maybe it'll help. So I think that's quite funny when I think back at her, like, okay, I'm with you, except to the point of the messy room. So even when I approached MUFON when I was 22, about my experiences, I was still doing most of these things. The room at that age didn't have the clutter in it, but I still had the light on every night. Every single night I had the light on in either radio or TV. And I was still very afraid to go to bed, and I would stay up as late as possible just to protect myself. So come to this one regression about my experiences over Shirley's place. She had taken me into the room, and by this time we'd explored many of the different things that had happened to me. Many of them, but you know, since I was going to her at age 22, just about everything we covered was my childhood. So at this point, she had me lay back in the chair, this big lazy boy recliner, and she took me, you know, into the hypnotic induction, and then said, for this session, we're going to just see where we go. Just whatever you think is important, just let it bubble up, let it surface. Because in all the other regressions that we did, we covered a specific event. Let's look at this event. Now let's look at this event. Now let's look at this event. But here she said, you know, just sort of freeform it. So different fragments of memories would start to come to the surface in my super relaxed state. I am a big supporter of hypnotic regression. I think that done well, it is a tremendous tool. So I'm trying to imagine many of the different things that were coming up and bring them back up to my memory. And what was happening was that every time that I would start to have something form by way of memory, I felt it being blocked, like something was intentionally blocking my memories from coming back. And when I had made so many attempts, I just sort of laid back. I'm like, geez, this isn't really working out, this sort of freeform style. And then the room started to get lighter. It was a very dim room, but the room started to get lighter and lighter and brighter.
And did she recognize this too? Was she seeing this?
No, she didn't. She didn't recognize any of this. I could tell by what she said afterwards. So I was just sitting there, and the room got brighter and brighter and brighter until everything was just dazzling white, just pure white. And I felt lighter and lighter as the light intensity increased. And then it felt as though the walls fell away and the ceiling went off the house, and that I was just floating in this open white space. And so I was just, and it was peaceful. It wasn't nerve-wracking. It was just very strange. And I felt like I wasn't in time or space anymore, is the best way to put it. It was just so odd. I was just floating there. And this voice spoke to me and said, "You always focus on the negative things. All of those things that you were trying to think up and remember and pull back to your memory, those, you know, you always go straight to the negative, you know, the victim, you know, material, I guess, you know." But it was this deep, full telepathic voice that was just rolling right through me. And it said, "You are afraid that we will come back and take you again. We know this, but we are here to put your doubts at rest about whether or not we will come back, because we're telling you we will come back again and again and again. So you don't have to question whether or not we'll be back, because we will be." And I'm thinking, like, I understand that it believes it's telling me something that it thinks is reassuring, but, you know, that's not exactly a reassuring message. And then it said, "And you also wonder about how your life will turn out." And the voice said, "We can see your full life from beginning to end. And let us tell you, you'll be fine." And at that point, I started to feel heavier and heavier. And the room grew darker and darker and darker. And I felt like somebody just slammed me back into the chair at high velocity. And that suddenly I felt like I was over 1,000 pounds in that chair. I just so heavy. And then I started to be able to move my arms and neck and head and toes. And then Shirley noticed that, who was sitting next to me. And she says, "Oh, you're back." And she goes, "I lost you for a while." And you know, I realized that she had no idea what had happened to me. And what it was wasn't, you know, I didn't go back in a regression. I left time and space itself, is the best way I can put it. It was a very real in the moment experience that I'd had. And so when I was able to get up, and I said that I told her I had to go to the bathroom, and she said, "Okay, you know, I'll wait for you in the other room." So I left the office that we were in, and I was in the bathroom. And they lived in a trailer home, which had very thin walls, understandably. So I could hear when Shirley came out and started talking to her husband, George, who was laying in the couch in the next room. And he was laying there the whole time. When I showed up, he was laying on the couch. When I went in the room, he was still laying on the couch. When I came out, still laying on the couch. So he was there for the entire session. And I heard him say to her, his wife, he's like, "They were here." And she said, "Who is here?" He goes, "There were three of them in the bedroom." And she's like, "Oh." And I knew exactly what he was talking about. So I come out of the bathroom and I go up to him, and they both have these ashen looks on their face. I said, "Hey, what's up?" And Shirley's like, "Oh, nothing." And I said, I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, "You're not going to tell me, are you? So I don't know if I want to tell you what happened to me either." And so I just said, "I got to go. I have to go." And then I just went out the door, hopped in my car. That was my last regression session with her. Sadly, George passed shortly after, and Shirley decided to go on sort of a sabbatical, to which she never fully returned. And yeah, that was my last regression session with her. But when I went home that night and I was laying in bed, I'm like, you know, I don't need the TV or the radio on, and I don't need the light on. And since that point, you know, back in 93, I've been fine in that respect. It certainly wasn't the last of my encounters, but it didn't matter. I was comfortable just going to bed and turning the lights off. Somehow what had happened to me that day had a profound, deep effect on me that had its intended purpose. And I, you know, even though I doubted it on the spot, like, you know, you guys really aren't comforting me as much as you think you are, maybe, but really, it worked out.
Well, that's remarkable. And that's to hear you say it so completely. You had to boil that down a little bit during the presentation. That was really remarkable. That's now the fellow who was lying on the couch. Now he actually saw three beings.
Yes. Yeah. And, he, if I remember his full context, he said that there were three, and he used some sort of word like beings or entities, just besides saying three of them. And they were down the sort of the shotgun hallway in George and Shirley's bedroom is where he said that they were.
And where was that in relationship to the room where you were having the regression?
On the exact opposite side of the trailer home. The one room is on, yeah, the exact opposite side of the other room. But, he said that they had showed up shortly after we had gone in the room and then left just a few minutes before we exited the room.
And he was paralyzed?
Well, the thing is that he had cancer at the time. And although he could move, he was in pain. And so he just, I don't know, you know, he was able to get up, but I don't know why he didn't. Yeah, again, they were not going to tell me what had happened. So, yeah.
And you also implied earlier that they were both experiencers.
Yeah.
This is remarkable. This is just remarkable. I mean, just the how rich these stories can be and how much is going on. You know, you talked about the people who just walk around and just deny this and don't believe it's happening and just doesn't even enter their psyche. There's like, well, where's the proof? And these stories, the richness of these stories in a way is their own proof. Like, I just got to say, nobody would make up the story you just told right now. So hey, I'm going to just bring one little thing up because I just feel like it was interesting. Just before you and I started talking, for the recorded part of the interview, we were talking just down here on Skype, and I can't remember how it came up, but you told a story about seeing sparkles in your room.
Mm-hmm. This was actually a fairly recent thing. It was in the last year or two. I think I have it recorded when it exactly happened, but I don't remember offhand. But just the gist of it was I walked into my bedroom. It was nighttime. And there was this cloud of diamond-shaped lights just sort of shimmering in front of me. And it was just a few feet tall, I would say, maybe 4 to 5 feet even. And it was just hanging there in the air, just sort of glimmering. And I watched it, and I wasn't necessarily nervous about it. I was just, I'm like, wow, this is, you know, really pretty and interesting, and what is this? And, you know, it wasn't some trick of the eyes because I watched it for about 5 seconds, which is a good long time to make sure, you know, I'm actually seeing this. And then it just blinked out. And yeah, no idea, but it was something.
Now, then I chimed in and said, so Andrea and I live in this beautiful old farmhouse here in upstate New York. And we're in the bedroom, just, it was dark out and it was evening. And then all of a sudden there was these sparkles in this corner of the room. And I can just right at the foot of the bed, sort of near this little bookshelf. And it was about human sized and about human proportioned, let's say. And it probably lasted 2 seconds. In the way I described it, the only way I can describe it, it looked like a bad special effect from an old, like, Doctor Who episode. You know, it would look like a really cheesy video effect. It just was like twinkle, twinkle, twinkle. And these little twinkles were there and then they were gone. And I was like, Andrea, did you just see the twinkles there? And she was like, yes, yes, the twinkles. And then we got right back into the discussion we were having. Both of us were like totally nonchalant about it. And in retrospect, I'm like, that's pretty weird to have like both of us see twinkles in the foot of the bed. And there's more to the story where I think there was some events that were taking place where she would have memories at night and she would felt that beings were at the base of the bed. And that was right. She pointed right to that spot. And I think I've got that correct. Now, I've also, this is like something I had never really heard of either. And we both talked about the fact, like, we're involved in this and we haven't really heard about the sparkles in the room. And I talked to Yvonne Smith a little over a year ago in Los Angeles. And I asked her like a couple of questions. She said, has anything happened to you recently? And I said, well, there was these sparkles in the room. And she kind of nodded like, oh yeah, the sparkles, the twinkles. I think she called them the twinkles. Yep. People report the twinkles. And I was like, how have I not heard of the twinkles? So I guess we both confirmed each other's story in a way just before we started this recorded conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have no idea what to make of it. Don't know what context to put it in, but you know, you just look at it and say, well, you know, weirder things have happened, you know?
Yes. Weirder things have happened. Now we're approaching the end of our hour talk here. And I just want to say one thing. Last spring, I interviewed a woman named Elizabeth Anglin, and she wrote a book titled Experience. She grew up in Michigan, and she talked about the experiences she had, her contact experiences growing up in Michigan. And I just marvel at the fact that your book, in many ways, was a little sort of nostalgic for me, not so much in the UFO stuff, but more just like, I knew the towns you were driving around in. I kind of know exactly what it means to drive around at night in high school in Michigan and what the weather's like and summer and things like that. So her story and your story are eerily similar, including the location and the title. Her book is called Experience. Your book is called Experiencer. So you have an extra R in your book. I don't even know if that's important, but I really recognized it when I reread your book prepping for this interview.
Yeah, I'll enjoy finding and reading her book.
I have to ask about your out-of-body experiences that you had in your youth.
I certainly had them, and they have been in large part connected, I feel, to my encounter experiences. When I was 4 years old, a trio of the beings came into my room. It was full daylight, and all my older brothers were at school. My dad was at work. My mom was at home out in the front yard picking weeds. And I went into my room and laid down on my bed. And the very second that I laid down, I felt paralyzed, just instantly paralyzed. And then I felt like somebody was pulling me out sort of through my chest, almost like when a pulls a handkerchief out of a pocket, like just plucked me out. And then there were three beings there, and they were very playful in nature, although it's not like their facial expressions changed. But these three little grays took me out into the hallway and had me lay. They wanted me to lay on my stomach, which at that point I realized that something really was different, because when I imagined myself laying, I just sort of drifted down to the ground. It wasn't like physically laying down. I was clearly in some other sort of state. And now, I mean, it was obvious that I was out of body. And they wanted to see if I could fly down the stairs. They asked me to drift down the stairs into the room that was at the bottom of the stairs, which I did easily, just floated on down, and then I fell on the ground. Well, I laid gently on the ground in a falling leaf motion. And then the three of them were all around me, and they were delighted. And they were like, this is just great. This is just wonderful. And I said to them, you know, I got to tell my mom about this. And they're like, oh, no. All telepathic, right, from on their end. I'm like, no. This is just between us, you know, this is just between us. And so I was kind of puzzled at that. And then they brought me back and popped me back into my body. And so when I was able to get up and out of my room, I went looking around for the house for them. I couldn't find them. And then I decided to see if I could actually float down the stairs on my own, and like without their help. And so I laid on the ground, and then I crawled face first down the stairs. I'm like, this is not the same. This is not at all the same. And, you know, as I got older, it was very clear that they were testing me. They were training me, seeing if I could handle myself out of body. And to them, that was very important that I could do that. And one of the things I really believe about at least some of the experiences that I've had is that they don't always come in a physical form if they don't need to. They can come sort of, if you will, via the astral plane or whatever term you want to use for being out of body. This way they don't have to figure out how they're going to hide their craft or even bring their craft. They don't need to switch people off or try to figure out how to sneak in and out of the house and all the logistics that come with that when it could just come consciously. If they don't need your physical form, if they could come consciously, then you know that's what they do. And so I think it explains why a lot of this phenomena happens and there aren't witnesses or any sort of physical traces, because I think their civilization has gotten to a point where they can sort of pop in and out of physicality. And I mean, it's a long, complicated fall down the rabbit hole to really unpack more of that. But in a very broad sense, I think that they aren't necessarily physical all the time when they come to us.
And I get that. I mean, I sense that too. And I spent so many years compulsively reading like abduction literature. Like I don't know where I got this story, but at some point I read an account where someone told a story in that they had been abducted the night before. Like, oh, I had a contact experience. I was taken from the bed. And the people in the house said, no, we saw you in bed and there was a pale blue glow around you, but you were just in the bed. We tried to wake you. We couldn't wake you, but there was a gentle pale blue glow around you. But the person was adamant that they had been taken the night before. And the witnesses in the house said, perhaps this was in some sort of unconscious level or some sort of dream level. And there's also a researcher, and she was actually a channeler too. She channeled a lot of material. She her name was Ida Cannenberg, and she put out these very odd little books. And she said exactly what you just said, that it is very easy for these beings. So just because she says it doesn't make it true, but I remember thinking that it made so much sense that they can travel, as you said, using, let's call it the astral plane, to arrive and then have these contact experiences play out sort of internally within the consciousness so that they don't need to fly a big metal craft across the universe to get to your doorstep. So yes, I'm in agreement on that one. And then the out-of-body experience shows up in the research that Ray Hernandez did recently. He put out a big, giant, thick, fat book. And I remember reading in that book that experiencers report out-of-body events or out-of-body experiences a disproportionately higher number than let's say, the standard cross-section of the population, which I do not doubt at all. So they are confirming what I sensed intuitively.
Yeah, and all through my life, I'd had many of these out-of-body experiences, most of them with the beings. And then in those moments where I find myself out of body, generally, I have never been able to master it, control it. But those times that I find myself out, I feel like I'm being observed while I do it, even though if I don't see them around me.
Hey, I just got the book out that I was talking about earlier, and it was edited by Ray Hernandez. And the title of the book is Beyond UFOs, and the subtitle is The Science of Consciousness and Contact with Non-Human Intelligence. This is a big, fat book. It's like 800 pages long. Now, early on in the book, they have a whole bunch of charts and such, and they include questionnaires that were given to what they are calling contact experiencers. And the very first question on table 11 is, have you ever had an out-of-body experience? And 80% answered yes, and 20% answered no. And that is a remarkable statistic. That is much higher than I would have dared to guess. Hey, we've only got a few minutes left of this interview, and I wanted to ask, is there anything... I know a lot has gone on in your life, and much, much more than we can really cover in this talk in any meaningful way. But before we go, is there anything you want to make sure that the listeners know?
the book that I put out 10 years ago includes that I have more to say, which I definitely do. There is a period of my life, of my early 20s, where it was just really bonkers and with experiences. And if you look at my book, the one that I was able to put out, it's a bunch of sort of vignettes of single serving experiences through, you know, a couple decades of my life. But pretty much all my early 20s was one big tied together, I guess, super experience, where all of the things that were happening were involved with other events that were happening to me. Very, very deep and complicated. It's difficult for me to put out a book like that at this point in my life with my family, as supportive as they are, because a lot of the material involves girls that I was dating at the time, and it just feels a bit tacky to put that out. But there are YouTube videos of me that are out there that where I talk about that time in my life, though, still. So that to me, it just is really fascinating to me that I think that these entities take an active interest in people's lives, who they date, where they live, possibly where they work, people involved in their lives. And to me, it's a huge mystery why these beings take such a direct approach in guiding people's lives to be where these beings feel they should be. You know, that's one of the biggest things, the biggest mysteries that, you know, I'm really struggling to try to figure out. And so I just try to embrace the mystery and enjoy life as much as possible, knowing that not everybody experiences the same things that other people experience. But, you know, just to go with it, go with the flow.
And I saw a talk you gave at an experiencer event, and that was specifically for experiencers. So the room was filled with people who have had these contact events. And the talk you gave resonated so strongly with me, because there was a point in my life when things went completely bonkers, and every little synchronicity was like tied into some other synchronicity. And once again, there was like a lot of stuff that felt very orchestrated. And it was like this knot, this tangled knot that would be impossible to try to untangle and almost impossible to try to share. So I understand more than you know about that, exactly what you just described. And bonkers is the perfect word for it.
That'll be a good subtext, experience or two, bonkers.
Okay.
Yeah. So. If I ever get out of the book, yeah.
Well, if that book ever comes out, I would love to read it. Who knows what the future will bring. Bill, it has been such a delight to spend this time with you, and I don't want to let it go for another 5 years or so since the last time we spoke.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the work you do, I find very nourishing. So I got to say, keep up the good work yourself. You're doing wonders for the community.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And I'm trying my best to, I feel a sense of mission. I mean, that's right out of the UFO playbook, the sense of mission. But I really, truly feel it. And I'm trying to do to live up to the intensity of these experiences and present them in a way that is palpable to both the people who have had the direct experience as well as people peering in from the outside. So yes, so once again, thank you so much. And yes, let's keep in touch.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me on, Mike.
You are very, very welcome.